I'm here. Welcome to the deepest lore. I haven't slept since the 6-hour epic 3 a.m. stream that we did last night, which was entirely impromptu. But it doesn't matter. I'm running on adrenaline. I've got Thomas Barden Reese with me here, as well as Simon Roberts. Thomas, welcome to the show, sir.
Well, thank you very much for having me on, Academic Agent. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I've been. I'm a fan of the old pro wrestling, and I like the way you basically cut promos on various personalities on YouTube, including a couple on me. I've been lured in by your antics. You may be interested to know that I may be debating Keith Woods later on.
Oh, really?
Your arch nemesis, yeah.
Yes. Are you gonna stick the dagger in him?
Well, I'm gonna show him to be a blue pill liberal for for being so wet on the issue of Carl Rittenhouse being a BLM supporter. So
I look forward to it.
We also have Simon Roberts, who appeared on Unpopular Opinions last week and is back for more.
I had my rookie tryout. I don't know if I passed, but when the call comes again, I'll be back. And thank you very much, AA, for having me on. Good afternoon, AA Thomas, and the chat. And I was going to bounce in here saying God bless Carl Rittenhouse, but after this morning's stream, I'm thinking better of it.
Let me just post the entropy link in the chat before we get going. You did well on your trial, by the way, Simon. I've offered you a £10 a week youth player contract.
Thank you very much.
Entropy is in the show notes. Buy all my courses. There's still the autumn 25 sale on. I should have spent the day writing a lecture, but instead I've been absolutely shattered because we stayed up all night streaming. Buy courses on the Academic Agency, autumn 25, blah blah blah. But today we're going to be discussing the issue of laddism. Now, if I was Ed Dutton, I would have dressed up and started the stream in, what would he do for his skit for this? He'd probably start with
Liam
here
Gallagher.
Here we go. Whoa, look at the set on them. Hey, lads. Hey. Because we are discussing the culture of the laddism of the 1990s. Now, I was in the thick of my teenage years during this period. I have my formative. I mean, that clip from Lee and Herring that I put on the start of this show is from that period. My friends from school are still essentially 90s lads. I was never really that keen on this whole culture, as we'll talk about, but it was kind of everywhere, and there were different strains of it, as we'll get into on this stream. But before we watch some clips that I've got lined up, Simon, you're a bit older. So what were you doing during this period of the laddism of the 90s?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the problem is my generation, the sort of, you know, mid-period Gen Xers were creating this stuff, and it didn't really touch me. I was in Australia for a long period between 81 and 94. And laddism, from what I can, from the research I've been doing, I mean, it seems to have started around, you know, 93, 94 when Loaded comes into play.
Yes,
And it didn't really hit me, you know, it wasn't really aimed at me. And I think your thesis about it being a sort of, again, another sort of top-down kind of cultural movement has a lot more weight after I've been looking into sort of various things like polling and, you know, the economic situation at the time and the sort of, you know, the baseline kind of cultural political purposes that might have been at play here. It's not just an innocent sort of spontaneous subversion by any means.
Lager, 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 shouting, yeah. Mega, mega, white thing, mega. I mean, you know, that was essentially my teenage years. Thomas, what were you up to during this period in terms of your, like, were you around during the peak laddism of the mid-90s?
Absolutely. I think I suspect that you and I are virtually the same age. I was born in 1980, so it was my sort of my prime teenage years were in the 90s. And of course, this laddism stuff was all about. Of course, the people in my school were very, you know, the lads in my school were very much into it. I sort of liked some of it, I suppose, but always because I was, I suppose, quite intelligent and sensitive. I didn't ultimately, you know, there was something that rankled with my soul, you know, with all this sort of laddish culture. And since being red-pilled, I came to see it's probably, you know, there is something probably very nefarious behind it all.
Thomas, did you own or have you ever owned a Ben Sherman shirt or a pair of Doc Martens? Because that was where I grew up. That was almost like the uniform that people used to go out in, you know, Ben Sherman shirt, Doc Martens. And then over time, that kind of morphed into there was also this skater thing going on during that whole period as well. And a surf thing, because I grew up near the sea. So in the summer, there were a lot of like O'Neill sunglasses and things like that. But yeah, did you ever own a Ben Sherman shirt?
You know, I think people bought them for me for my birthday once or twice. But I wasn't really one of the cool kids at school. So I do remember, you know, I wasn't really like dead on when I was at school or anything like that. I was a bit of a weirdo. So I certainly never lived up to any of these sort of, you know, cool types that were out there. But I do remember that my friends were into this kind of thing. Were you quite the poser academic agent? Or?
No. How can I say? I was a little bit, I kind of got on with a lot of people in school across the various hierarchies, if that makes any sense, while always being analytical and seeing and categorizing it as a kind of taxonomy. I wrote a novel when I was 18 or 19, which was essentially based on the schoolyard hierarchy. I remember I did something when I was 11 years old. This kid splashed some water on me and I didn't take kindly to that, and being into wrestling as I was, I slammed his head into the wall and he had to go to hospital.
Jesus.
this act of ultra violence bought me about 6 years worth of kudos, if that makes any sense. Terms of nobody was going to mess with me after this, you know. But also, I was able to trade on, weird things that kind of curry you favor with cooler kids, despite the fact that you're not really one of them. Like, for example, detailed football knowledge. Of tactics and things like this, which I mean, it sounds weird going back now, but these are the sorts of things that you could kind of talk about. You know, like I mentioned the wrestling, you know, that was
yes.
for a while. you know. Because a lot of, like, you know, a lot of schoolboy stuff is about, like, stuff, you know. So you can kind of, as long as you can carry a conversation, I suppose. And I was a little bit of a rebel as well with the teachers and things, which kind of has a little bit of a social credit, I guess, within the...
Even at high school?
Yeah. So, for example, I mean, one of the things I did once, we had a drama supply teacher, and I claim that my name was Denzel, and we carry this on for, like, the entire year. what else did I do? I refused to... I used my RE paper to, like, protest against some, like, minor aspect of theology or whatever, and it got me into a lot of trouble as well. So, you know, a couple of little scrapes like that. I mean, some of the kids in my school were pretty naughty. Like, I remember in one music class, this I won't name him, but this kid in my class, like, I mean, he'd literally sit there for the whole hour, and there's this thing in music called a slur. And I mean, he literally sat there for an hour going a slur like that over and over again. And I think he was going to drive his teacher mental. In that same period, they locked her in the cupboard for about half an hour. I mean, there was a lot of shenanigans that went on. And these sorts of things kind of, you know, and I was perfectly happy to write off, like, music, RE, art, design and technology. Gather around the front bench now, everybody. You know, make a pair of shorts in textiles. I mean, fuck all these subjects. You know, I didn't care about any of those. So there was quite a lot of subjects where you could just basically fuck around. Although I was a good student as well. shall we talk about some of the aspects of laddism in the culture? I do have some clips. I've got clips from Men Behaving Badly, various, like, weird documentaries that BBC4 have put on, footage of Rave, some bloke at The Guardian from 2015 defending lad culture, fantasy football, of course. I've chosen a fantasy football where the guests were Neil Morrissey and Danny Baker. So what else have we got? A show called Game On, where we'll play a bit of that as well. Which starred a kind of agoraphobe called Matthew, who bullied this ginger nerd called Martin. So we'll watch a couple of those things. But yes, was that not the case in your school, Thomas, where a certain amount of bad behavior could, win you over?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, if you were a rebel and you, you went against the teachers, then it was certainly, you got a certain amount of kudos. But whenever I tried anything like that, it always failed. I was just, because people just sort of, I don't know, it was just like, it just made me look even worse than what I was, if you know what I mean. Because the bullies sort of felt like I was trying to impress them. And if they had that feeling, they weren't very impressed when it came to me. And also, I will say, I was just scared a lot of the teachers. So
you're scared of the teachers?
Yeah, from 13 to 16, I found them quite scary. So I wasn't one, you know, I was very much, when I got to high school, I was very much like, stay in line. I think I was very introverted when I was 13. And so I just learned that it was best just to be quiet and alone in high school rather than trying, you know, impress the bullies.
Yeah, they saw through your stratagems, and rightly so. Mm. Rightly so. Simon, what about you?
In Australia, at school in the 80s, I was pretty much a shy kid as well, kept myself to myself. And it was that time where you had the sort of subcultural groups were beginning to sort of fall into slightly sharper relief. You know, there was basically a division between, you know, sort of what you'd call the mainstream kids and the so-called alternative set. And that was the word we used, you know, alternative music, alternative style, all that stuff. And they were kind of the sort of weird little coterie that I hung on the fringes of. But the makeup of the school in Australia where I went, which was Perth Modern High School, which is where several prime ministers had gone. Bob Hawke famously went there, but also Rolf Harris. And I tend to keep quiet about that. but he was an old Modernian boy as well. And it was sort of one of these schools that had been a kind of like an Australian version of an English public school, but had fallen on hard times and had gone to the state sector. So there was also a very mixed population as well. You had a lot of ethnic populations. You had the Greeks would all stick together. The Italians would all stick together. You'd have Vietnamese kids would be these would be the main sort of cultural groups, and sort of jockeying for position with the kind of alpha jock Australian kids would be the sort of the main social preoccupation. So laddism as a culture certainly hadn't you know, kicked in. There was just the kind of the raw sort of slightly brutal masculinity of you know, the alphas, and everybody else kind of, you know, cowed in their presence. So that was that's how it was for us.
If you ever do read my breakdown of the hierarchies, the breaking out of the alternative group who rebel against the emperor is built in to my structure. I call that group the Black Prince and his crony. I mean, in my they kind of went off on their own and listened to the Smashing Pumpkins you know, wore kind of, do you remember those like long Matrix jackets, you know, like the long black
In our day it was more the kind of ex-German army jackets, the old West German army jackets, and black jeans, Dr. Martens, boots usually, and you know, kids sort of dyeing their hair and, you know, listening to the Violent Femmes and the Smiths.
That group, well, you see, the 80s were cooler than the 90s in many ways. But that group in my year was a mixed year, was a mixed boys and girls group. Was that the same? Like
co-ed school where I was, certainly. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And those were, the kind of, I mean, I think the girls often took the social lead in those kinds of, alternative sets, as it were.
It's a different structure. You can't have the big pack of the big pack of boys there.
No.
The very mixedness of it is part of its alternativeness, if you want. I had a few times where I went out with those, like went and drank like gin on the roof or whatever it was, I didn't feel comfortable with them. My sympathies have always been towards, despite like despising it. I always hated the hierarchy, right? But I also, my sympathies were like pro bully always. so even though I kind of hated it, I also kind of thought it was just and right. And so therefore, as a matter of Machiavellian politic, kind of paid lip service to the hierarchy as well. But not at the expense of fundamental integrity. So I remember there were some people who would basically sell out their grandmother to be with the cool kids, you know, sell out their friends in a heartbeat to you know, get the invite to that party or whatever it was. And I always disdain that was kind of low grade behavior as well, because I mean, that was the other thing about the 90s, is that it was inbuilt into the aesthetic of what cool was to basically not care about anything as well. Like a kind of
sang froid,
like a detachment, which I get the impression has not always been the case, but it was very, apathy was a strong theme of 90s youth, I would suggest. I mean, I remember being kind of a little bit upset with that and thinking that our generation had no cause. We had nothing to like fight for or against or anything.
It's what you talked about on previous streams about irony and sincerity. You know, earnestness was pretty frowned upon.
And, but we had literally nothing to worry about apart from literally Tory sleaze or, you know, at the time this was like oh, Tony Blair's doing some of his meetings behind closed doors instead of debating it in Parliament. It's hardly right. It's not exactly Vietnam, is it? Do you know what I mean? There was nothing to get our teeth stuck into until Iraq came along. But I always thought that was being a kind of hipster and Daria type figure. I was pro Iraq war at the time because I just hated the fact that everybody was defaulted to being anti it. So given my contrarian nature, I found reasons to literally support Tony Blair in his warmongering. But I think that was probably a mistake.
I made that mistake as well. And I thought I was very sophisticated to imagine that war is justified, you know, against an evil dictator like Saddam. I thought I was very clever at the time and realized later on that I was profoundly wrong.
Yeah, well, I didn't. You see, my position was always back then, I don't care. Nobody cares about Saddam. This is just kind of the Machiavellian realpolitik. This is the way the world works. I read a book by Robert Kagan, who was a neocon, called Paradise and Power. And he basically sold me that, you know, the Westphalian world order never really went away outside of Europe, and that America had to play in the real world type thing. I now realize the folly of my ways. I thought it, you know, back then I thought that was the kind of next level take, and everybody listening to Noam Chomsky was cringe. That was my thought. Mm.
Certainly a lot of my contemporaries who, you know, we're all a bit older and working at this point and a lot of them in London in the sort of nascent stages of the internet, you know, what people used to call digital production, essentially. So people who were sort of just getting to grips with it and starting to provide content. They were very much taken in by Blair. And I'd been listening to his speeches for a long time before the 97 election. And I was kind of a sort of classical liberal at that time, really a kind of libertarian kind of minded person. And I just heard the nanny state in everything he said. And I just tried to point to it and say, don't you get what this guy's about? You know, I'm not trying to claim, you know, prescience or hindsight. It was just the way he struck me that he wanted to come in and sort of fix everything with legislating.
One of the things that's difficult to remember, like being a teenager, is that a lot of those sorts of conversations about nanny state don't really mean anything to you. Don't really understand what they're on about. I mean, I spent a lot of time listening to talk radio, as I mentioned before, you know, James Whale and Mike Dickin and people like this. But I never really understood the discussions around the size of the state. It just meant nothing to me. I didn't have a conception of what like benefits were, for example. Mm. You know, when you're 16, it means nothing. It
doesn't have any social purchase either.
It goes over your head. So the only things I understood were like, yeah, this guy wants to sort out crime and he sounds like he's got a plan, or yeah, like let's go to war. Good. And I think that's easy to forget when you're a teenager. Now people will flip around and say, yeah, but what about your criticisms of Rittenhouse, AA? That's different, and I'll get to that when I speak to Keith later on. Just before we start these clips then, does anyone have any more general comments about this era, or shall we watch these clips?
I'm happy to watch the clips.
Yeah, okay. Go first. I've got stuff to say later on, maybe.
Yeah, okay. All right, so let's... this is just to give you a bit of a flavor of what the era was like. So here are some clips of Men Behaving Badly, which was a big sitcom of the time. And some of my friends are still like, they still watch old videos of this. Even now, they just kind of stuck in that era, still watching this stuff, basically. Let's have a little look.
Going along with the grain of the face.
A little bit girly, isn't it?
Got to look after my skin now, you know. That's got Caribou's placenta in it.
Ooh, you want to send that back, then, won't you?
Oh, no. That's good, that, you see. That cleanses the pores gently but firmly, caressing and cajoling them individually to a maximum performance.
Mm, doesn't it?
Mm.
Good for pulling birds, then, is it?
Huh? Should be. Cost me 28 quid. Apparently, it's especially good for sensitive skin.
Note a second here that this was against the grain of the metrosexual already, and his immediate concern, the Martin Clunes character, was pulling birds, which is a reoccurring theme that we'll see, because a huge part of laddism was pulling birds, which fed directly into my life experiences, which involved phrases such as "every hole's a goal," "what goes on tour stays on tour," and so on and so forth. Did you fellas experience any of that heavy pressure to pull birds, etc.?
I remember the every hole is a goal, but I didn't live by that sort of philosophy. I certainly remember all of this. I think what I would say is that watching these shows, it gives you the false impression about how you're meant to behave around women. And I can remember in my teenage years trying to impress women by being an idiot like they are, you know, like being a bit of a clown, drooling at the mouth over women and this kind of thing. And women are not impressed by this. They're really not.
Yeah. For me, I was always a bit of an oddball and an outsider. I always have been, always will be. And I think I had a sort of strange, you know, bitter little group of friends that I used to hang around with who were also kind of weirdos. But there was never this kind of thing. The thing I notice about this clip is the Morrissey characters picking up on the kind of it's all about the sort of fag end of the new age man trope from the 80s. This idea of sensitizing yourself to women's desires and, you know, adopting the kind of ornamental culture of women as well in your presentation and all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, it's all a little bit, but I won't say anything more about that, but you know what I mean.
I think there is built into this, as we'll get onto as this goes on, there is a reaction against a type of feminism in all of this as well, a kind of reassertion of masculine identity in a kind of pathetic way, which then later on gets kind of, I don't know exactly when it happened, but it kind of like completely disappeared, this whole thing, and all of a sudden we were in the moment where Sargon was moaning about like Emma Watson or whatever. So I don't know exactly when that happened. We'll maybe be able to pinpoint it as this goes on. But you see, there's some sort of rebellion even in the show against the notion that a man should have to care for his skin. You know. Anyway, let's carry on.
I'm a bit worried about you, mate.
Why?
Well, let's face it. You don't go and power saw your bird stuffing ass in the middle of a dinner party, do you? I mean, and not unless you're really stressed, eh?
Don't worry about me, old son. I will survive. I will survive!
Now, that scene there, I reckon I experienced that scene in real life many times, especially when I was at university. One of the things I'm interested in is the extent to which people saw these behaviors on something like Men Behaving Badly and then just recreated, like they thought, well, this is what you're meant to do, get drunk and do this sort of thing. What do you guys think?
Go on, Thomas. Were you going to say something? Yeah? No? Okay, I'll leap in. I mean, the thing I notice about this is you realize actually the characters here, they're already a little bit too old, if you know what I mean. It reminds me a bit of Spaced. Do you remember Spaced with Simon Pegg?
Yeah.
Where it was kind of part of the meme of it was that these were sort of 20 somethings who were already a bit past their sell by date and they were seeing the sort of youngers coming up underneath them. I'm just looking at Morrissey there. He's almost looking a bit jowly. And it just seems like actually part of this is it's not really aimed at the 16 to 25s, which is what lad culture seems to have been about. These are kind of getting to be a bunch of sad blokes, probably in their early 30s by the look of it, who, who are sort of, you know, acting out this stuff and, you know, being losers for it as well.
Yes. I mean, I've never really thought about how the older people were meant to take this, you know, like a 40-year-old watching this as opposed to like a 16-year-old. But I do think that people who were 15 and 16 saw this and thought, well, this is how you're meant. This is what adult men do type thing. Thomas, any thoughts?
Yes, I entirely agree. It should never be underestimated how prone people are, especially teenagers are, to copying what they see on the television screen in front of them. And of course, one of the ultimate horrors of this phenomena that we've seen in recent years is pornography, where, you know, when people have sex these days, they sort of behave, you know, like what they've seen in porn movies. So I totally agree with the point.
Yeah, although there is a point to say, well, did people do this in real life and this is just a reflection of that? Or is this a kind of top down? Because I could, like, people have always got drunk, for example, in British culture. But, like, I don't know, because there's other elements of this that we haven't talked about. Like, these are two middle class guys, for one,
yeah,
as opposed to two working class guys. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. It's not the likely lads, is it? You know.
For instance, she doesn't understand that lager is a metaphor for life itself. The beer mats are the, if you like, the squidgy ground beneath our feet. The glass
is like the clothing around our body. Only glass clothing.
Yeah. And the lager itself is the body with its lovely foamy little curly little hair.
Yeah, and the peanuts. You see, the peanuts
are just peanuts, really.
Oh. See, there was a heavy emphasis on the idea of the pub of pub culture and of, like, glorifying the idea that you're meant to love going for pints. Basically, you're meant to love lager. This is a huge part of laddism, as well as pulling bird. You're meant to love pints of lager. Simon, do you love pints of lager?
I'm not, actually. It's funny. It's the one thing I don't drink. I drink spirits. I drink ciders. I drink wines. I don't drink beer, actually. So it's difficult to relate to. And as I say, it all feels a little bit like, as I say, these guys are slightly too old for it. And of course, I was sort of slightly too old for it myself. I didn't actually watch Men Behaving Badly very much at the time. But you're right. It's very much about sort of performative masculinity in a kind of really crude way, and I think that all ties in with the kind of thesis you've hinted at about this is a sort of very much a curated thing, this phenomenon that sort of comes and goes. And I think there's a specific sort of purpose to it at this moment in time, probably politically and culturally as well.
I mean,
you're a lager, yes, man.
Absolutely not. Even when I used to drink a bit of alcohol when I was sort of 16, I always hated things like lager and beer. And of course, my friends thought I was very gay for not liking the taste of beer or lager. But I really couldn't stand it. But the issue here is that it's sort of selling you this lifestyle where you should, the only things you should care about are drinking and having fun and, you know, lecturing at women. And there's no higher purpose. There's no sense of responsibility or anything like that. I mean, I don't want to sound like a killjoy. I know it's just a comedy program, but ultimately, when you see where we've headed ultimately in the noughties and, you know, in the last 10 years, you can see that this was sort of positioning us, you know, it was positioning us in a place from which, you know, full-on nihilism could follow.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that interests me about this whole thing, you know, the month before, I had a long ongoing saga about the bloody Zoomers or Coomers. Do you remember the licking the tomboy abs thing?
Mm-hmm.
My interlocutors in that debate were Adam and Sitch. And they had a conception of masculinity that was essentially built on the notions inherited from laddism. You know, that, like, the true man, he'd be out banging lots of girls and he'd be, he'd essentially be like one of the, like, Gary or Tony from Men Behaving Badly. And I'm kind of interested in why this vision of masculinity was pushed in this moment of the 90s where there was kind of nothing really going on. other than the unraveling that they talk about in the Fourth Turning. Because it seems a very weak thing to build your identity on, and yet it was very successful to the point where, like I said, there are still people who build their identities on this now, very much so, and in fact they'll quickly default to it, you know, at a game of rugby or whatever stag do, etc. Let's carry on.
How many hours a week you spend in front of the television?
2.5
I counted recently, Gary, 52.
Oh, come off it. I'd have to get in from work and switch on the telly immediately and then watch it every night till after midnight and still put in 12 hours a day at the weekend.
Exactly.
Yeah, but you learn a lot from the television, don't you? I mean, I've got all my knowledge of the world through the TV.
Where's Bosnia, Tony?
No, see, that's news. I don't watch the news.
Do you think there was an element of the show that was actually trying to make fun of men as well? Seems like it, doesn't it?
Hugely. Hugely.
These are the best bits of the show, by the way. Just let you know.
Christ.
Whatever you want, but don't hit my face.
Gary.
It's me.
See, these were acceptable modes of behaviour. Weirdly. So let's carry on.
Oh, dear.
Now we're going to watch the opening credits of Fantasy Football, another huge part of lad culture. And then I've picked out a little moment 10 minutes in where Neil Morrissey of Men Behaving Badly and Danny Baker drop in. But let's just watch the highlight, the opening credits with Badil and Skinner. And Stato, of course.
This most enjoyable afternoon of the season, this. Right, you. Off. Oh, come on, ref, he never touched him.
Look at his face. Just look at his face.
He's off. Oi, ref, do you want to borrow these? If you're looking for a level-headed manager, he's your man.
Because I would suggest football was another part of laddism.
Yeah.
How much were either of you two boys into football?
Hold my hands up. Not at all. Never have been, unfortunately.
I was a huge football fan, AA. And as I've said before, you're one of the few people in distant circles who seems to have my sort of interest in football. So I was certainly interested in football. And I think fantasy football, despite the fact that I hate David Baddiel, and I hated him probably at the time, I do think it was good in some ways. You know, if you were a football fan, it's a good way to relax on a Friday evening. And it was good that somebody pointed out all the sort of comedy moments that were going on in football. So in that sense, I don't have much of a problem with fantasy football. I think, of course, one of the worst things about it is David Baddiel, because he was happy to take the piss out of everyone on that show. And now, of course, he's one of the worst SJWs out there, really.
Yeah, I mean, we can talk about Baddiel. We can talk about Baddiel, possibly, because David Baddiel was in a double act with Rob Newman on something called the Mary Whitehouse Experience, which I remember being on. In fact, Newman and Baddiel sold out Wembley, famously. I think the first ever comedy duo to do so. And if you watch that, it was a very middle class kind of Oxbridge affair, really. And then suddenly Newman, I don't know what happened to Rob Newman, he went off to become like a peak oil activist or something. Like he went serious and stopped being a big comedian, effectively. And so Baddiel then somehow ended up with Frank Skinner and kind of reinvented himself from being this kind of sardonic middle class Jewish comedian and very kind of university educated type, to kind of being this like icon of new laddism with Frank Skinner and like this kind of Euro 96 football culture, essentially. And I don't know how that happened. I still don't really understand what the deal was there. Other than the fact that I know Badil was a big Chelsea fan through his dad, but I don't really know. Yeah, so we can speculate maybe on what was going on, depending on if we believe that new laddism was a genuine phenomena or a top down kind of pushed phenomena. But let's just have a little look at a little bit of fantasy football.
Off you go. Beer at seven, get my cold beer at seven, and if I cold beer at
seven, get my cold beer at seven. Now, anyway, we had a letter from Andy Lee from Stoke, right? Come on, pay attention. And he said, I was flicking through my girlfriend's copy of Fiesta when I noticed... You see, I believed it
as well.
When I noticed the photo of Gary Lineker,
can I just say there was a widely held perception in this era as well that only Frank Skinner was funny out of these two. That Billy was just kind of there. I don't know if you remember that, Thomas.
I didn't know that, but I didn't. Yeah, I didn't really talk about this with many people. I'm glad that was the case, though.
Yeah, it was a. It was a very commonly held belief. So anyway, let's see where this goes.
They're in the Reader's Wives section. <There's Gary. laughs>
Well, clearly a lot of you have been looking at the Reader's Wives section of... various pornographic magazines, because Mr. G. Dyskins says that whilst idly flicking through a magazine, he came across this picture of Peter Schmeichel. going on then.
The Great Danes, they say.
That's not them, do you think?
It's Neil Morrissey and Danny Baker. Ah.
Now, Baker is still around, or at least he was a couple of years ago, because I seem to remember he got involved in some sort of race row, didn't he, Baker, and got fired.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, thanks. Oh, gentlemen. Reader's Wives, eh?
Yeah, very good.
Yeah.
Hey. See, look, the football shirt, the beer bottle, these are key kind of... These are key markers of what male identity was at this time. Now, it may sound like I'm trying to deconstruct it like a feminist here, which I kind of am, but I'm doing it from the other way. I'm doing it from the way is like, what was the culture up to when it was pushing this as a kind of norm for me? Why was culture trying to make me this here? Why was it trying to make you this, Thomas? And this is a question I want to ask on today's stream. What was it up to? Why is it pushing this? What do elites have to gain from you being a kind of beer guzzling football fan?
Well, I'll go first then. I would say it's just that there's probably two prongs to this sort of attack. And the first is that really intelligent people, clever people, people with a soul, people who might be leaders of society, they just feel pulled down into the gutter by all of this sort of laddish stuff. So anyone with any kind of higher purpose in life soon feels demoralized on account of all this stuff. And then the second case, I'd say that it's also true that whilst the sort of proles might superficially enjoy this, they also need some spiritual nourishment. They also need some, something to work for in life, something to become in life. And so by sending them down this route of this sort of nihilistic, laddish culture, you take that out of them as well. And so I would say that those are the problems with this kind of thing. That was the aim of pushing this kind of lad culture.
Can I just say something? People says, oh, academic agent has no place talking about working people. I don't think this was pushed at working people. I don't think this is an attempt. this is an attempt to write a version of kind of 80s or 70s working class culture onto middle class people. None of these people are like, I mean, I don't know about Danny Baker, but like clearly David Baddiel is not a working class boy, you know. You know, the two on Men Behaving Badly are not working class. So this was an attempt to, it was an attempt to give possibly a new class of people. Maybe these are people who would have been working class, but, you know, they made some money in the Thatcher era, where they were the kids of yuppies or something. But I don't get the impression that this is an organic working class or pro folk culture. It's obviously not what we're watching here. It's a construction.
Very conscious. I mean, it seems very much like, I mean, to use the sort of language you'd find in kind of postmodern texts in academia, you know, they're trying to inscribe the codes of the working class on these very obviously middle class people. These are not your average C2s or anything like that, that are the kind of focus, I think, of political campaigning at the time to capture that kind of, you know, the inheritors of the Essex man vote from the 80s to kind of pick up the Mondeo man. But it seems kind of faintly farcical with these guys, you know, who've I don't specifically know the backgrounds of these guys. I mean, can I just ask, were these shows popular? I never watched them. I mean,
Fantasy Football was massively popular. Right. I mean, Men Behaving Badly was prime time BBC One type comedy show. You know, it was huge. Still is popular with some people. You know, but more in a kind of UK gold way. Do you remember Tony Blair going on like Football Focus and like Match of the Day and things? He used to, when he was campaigning, Blair would go and pretend to like football, and he tried to like talk with Alan Hansen and whoever.
I certainly remember that. And he would, you could tell he had been completely briefed on it, that he didn't have any real interest in the game. And he would just, you know, he'd say, oh, I thought Ferdinand's marking today was very good and on the point. And of course, Teddy Sheringham's always in and around the box sniffing for a goal. And
it was all like that, yeah.
Yeah, it was very fake.
I actually went back because I remember I was a huge David Bowie fan. Still am. But around this time, he won the Brit Award, like Lifetime Achievement Brit Award, and I remember he did like he sung a song wearing high heels, but he had that kind of spiky blonde hair around this time. He brought out an album called Earthling where he has that haircut. What I did not remember until I went back and watched the footage is that Tony Blair gave David Bowie that Brit Award in 1996. Now, consider that Blair didn't become the Prime Minister until 1997. So that's some pretty good product placement for, you know, Blair's spin machine to get himself on the Brits in 1996, I thought. You know.
Oh, I remember he was being called Prime Ministerial at the time before the election in, you know, his showings at PMQs and so on, and the major government being in the kind of disarray it was and mired in the sleaze that we referred to, you know, the other week. It was a kind of it all seemed inevitable with Blair. I'm afraid he was being propelled.
Yeah, no, I absolutely. Yeah, I remember on Spitting Image, which was the big political kind of puppet show, which I essentially learned politics through. When he was back when John Smith was the leader of the Labour Party, Blair was always depicted as a kind of as a schoolboy in a uniform because he was so young. But there was a moment where Blair like grew up all of a sudden on Spitting Image, and it was like from that point on it seemed like inevitable that he would be the Prime Minister. So anyway, let's see what they talk about.
Readers' Wives, you know what they do? Their graphic is at the top of the page for the Readers' Wives page.
It's a
ring donut, and after the ring donut, it's got one for the ladies, which is the husbands, and there's a long eclair. Effect, that's what they have at the top of the page.
I don't know what you're talking about, Dan.
That's where we bought the recent German signings from, I believe. He pronounces it like Minger. He pronounces it Minger, but it's spelled M-I-N-G-E.
This is filth, isn't it? It's absolute filth.
And yet they look bored.
Yeah, they do look bored.
have you been reading Fiesta recently? Or
no, I haven't actually. I've read it for years and years.
God, yeah, that's absolutely true. Actually, I always find that the best ones are those you find in hedgerows. So, what do you think about a sprayer and all that? You're not bothered about.
I'm not. You know. Do you want to pull at that thread? You know, I don't approve of the adulation of foreign players. You
no,
know
you don't, do you?
When players are clapped out on the continent, and I think Bergkamp's clapped out, and I still think your bloke's going to be proved to be clapped out. He's having a good season so far. One good season. Yeah. We're so grateful.
Who's that? Rude Hullet.
Oh, right.
One season. That's all they got. We buy them at the tail end, like Millwall bought Pep Van den Howe. Yeah. We were so grateful.
Danny Baker was right about that. Rude Hullet was clapped out at the end there.
Pep Van den Howe. And everyone I know who supports a Premier League club went, have him. And I believe that's what Europe says about the British clubs. That, oh, look at them turning cartwheels because they bought a 34-year-old bloke, the Dutch.
Yeah, he's only absolutely brilliant, though.
Yeah, but we should have it for one season. No, why don't Chelsea get some 70?
He's wrong about Bergkamp. I think Bergkamp had a good few years there. But it's funny, though, that this was a talking point back at this. Like, they were still allowed to talk about not wanting foreign players. I remember watching Jimmy Hill's Sunday supplement. And Jimmy Hill, I might be interested to go back and look at some of Jimmy Hill's views, but Jimmy Hill was always like anti-foreign players, which I found interesting. And they always talked about it from the point of view that if there were too many foreign players in the top league, the England football team would suffer. Do those talking points still exist? I feel like they've disappeared from the.
I feel like they've disappeared as well. But at one time, that was always a huge thing. And to be honest, I'm shocked or I'm surprised that Danny Baker just said what he did about, you know, he doesn't want foreign players in the league. But of course, this was a common talking point in the 90s, and it was in the noughties as well. I think it's just recently, probably in the last 5 or 10, well, just 5 years, I'd say, where all this talk has been really shunted out because it's not politically correct.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? And it is true that at this time, the Premiership would get like players who had just passed their peak, you know, like Ruud Gullit, for example. He was kind of past it. And Vialli when he turned up at Chelsea. I remember, by the way, that at my school, a pile of Manchester United fans became Chelsea fans almost overnight in the Vialli Gullit era. that turned me off the idea of supporting. That made me think that it was impure and pretentious to support clubs because of the fair weather way in which that happened. Also, people will forget this. Blackburn were a big side. Like they won the Premier League 1 year under Kenny Dalglish in 1995. Do you remember at the Sutton and Shearer up front? There was a pile of Blackburn fans who over the years basically like sidled over to where this, like, I remember by the time we ended school there was just one holdout Blackburn fan, but the others had somehow found their way to other clubs. And I, you know, growing up in Wales, I found that pretentious in the extreme. And then years later they all supported Swansea when Swansea were good, you know. So it's like, yeah, what do you think about the idea? Because that's another big thing that they push on you, that you need to have a football club as part of your identity. And it's really important if you're a Liverpool fan or a Manchester United fan, and you know, dictates what sort of posters you have in your room or what sort of pencil case you've got. Did you have a club, Thomas?
I didn't have a club because I was very, I thought I was above that kind of thing. And because I thought I could invest in individual players and individual managers, but I could never invest just in a club which would regularly change its players or managers. You know, I felt that was a bit beneath me. But certainly the proles enjoyed picking a club and, you know, going to every game, and even if it was rubbish, they would still support them. It's all a bit of a con, because, you know, the working class have been trained to put their hearts and souls into something which is ultimately just part of Globo Homo. So that's one thing. And then, of course, you get the sort of the glory supporters who just support the big teams, which is probably even worse. I think the whole thing is a bit of a mess, to be honest.
Hmm. I had a Sunderland strip at school. That was as close as I got to loving football, because I just needed to, you know, but this is the 1970s, you know, playing football up in Hartlepool, and you needed to wear football gear. So I just said, I'll pick that one, you know, and it was just a blue away strip or something that they had at the time. And I really wanted the one with the red and white stripes, and I was kind of disappointed. And the only other intersection I had was collecting the Panini stickers, actually.
That was a huge thing as well, yeah.
Massive, massive. I mean, we had... I've got a book full of the Europa 80, all the Panini stickers and stuff. And I just thought this was just throwaway shit. And then I look on eBay, and these things go for like 300, 400 quid. You know...
I always remember the Shinies and, you know...
Oh, yeah.
I'll give you two ill Barretts for one...
But you always had to write off at the end, didn't you, and sort of get the ones that you couldn't find, because you suspected they were probably being withheld from the market somehow.
Yeah, exactly. I did the same trick every year where me and my friend would go in joint, you know, so we'd have one book between the two of us, but I'd get to keep the book in my drawer, but he'd end up buying most of the stickers. So we had a joint pooled one, but I kept it because I liked the... I don't know if you remember, the Panini sticker books had stats in them. And I was quite kind of into, you know, seeing how many appearances they'd had last season and things like that.
Apparently the mistake is to write in them, though. I'd written in all the scores of the matches because I'd actually kept up. I mean, this is so long ago, I can't remember doing it. But apparently you're supposed to leave them pristine for the collectors. So too bad.
You know, it's funny you said that about just supporting like one player. I supported just one player. I even remember ringing in to Talk Sports or whatever it was called, Talk Radio, explaining this to, you know, Tommy Boyd or one of these sorts of characters, Gary Brazil or something. That player who I supported was Paul Parker, the England and Manchester United right back, because when I first watched, the very first tournament I watched of football was World Cup 90, okay? With, you know, Brian Robson. I remember that, you know, with Shilton, Parker, Des Walker. I think it was Mark Wright, Stuart Pearce that was left back. It was that team. Gazza was in that team. Lineker up front, Barnes. And I had this thing when I was a kid. We could maybe talk about why I had this view. I kind of like the black character in most things. So I like Mr. T out of the A-team, for example. And and obviously like Paul Parker was black, but also his name was Parker, which was hilarious to me as an 8-year-old. It was like Nosy Parker type thing. So I took a shining to Paul Parker and decided to support whoever Paul Parker played for. But unfortunately he broke his ankle when he was 33 and kind of retired. He went to Derby and he went to Chelsea for about four games, which nobody remembers.
Is that right? It's interesting what you say about the supporting the black player or liking the black player or the black person in a comedy or a television show. That was certainly my predisposition as well. And I think it was always because they were portrayed as being sort of the isolated, sort of lonely person who was kind of good. There was something like about the underdog that made you sort of root for them.
I even liked Miles Dyson in Terminator 2, and he was kind of like tiny bit villainy, you know. So, I also developed a point system as well for people. Do you remember that show 15-1? I had a point system where you'd get, like, if they had white hair, glasses, beard and moustache, you know, they'd gain a point. So I guess the ultimate person would be someone who was black with glasses and a white beard. But anyway, let's carry on. Let's carry on.
15-year-olds at their own ranks and have
not as good as Rudolph. And they have got 70-odd Dubarrys out the ranks, and he's brilliant.
Yeah, come on. He's had about four or five. Yeah, I think he's getting a bar on past reputation. Past reputation. He's having a good season.
All right, you two, just calm down. All right.
We'd kill for somebody who was good for one season.
But this was just basically football talk at this time. Kind of interesting. But is it a little bit performative, or were they just genuinely having this talk? I don't know.
As I said, the only foreigner we bought was Dowie, and we sold him again, didn't we?
I don't think the planet Zenon counts. This is the first foreign buy I remember, and Villa bought this bloke. He's an Argentine international. Can we see him there? And his name, I don't know if you remember him, his name was Ozzy Oscar Arse.
Oh. Oscar Arse, I don't remember that.
I remember my brother got it slightly wrong. My brother Keith came in the house and said, have you heard Villa's bought somebody called Alfie Arse? By the way, have you seen this? It's Manchester United Diet Cola.
So anyway, that was fantasy football. So there's some other bits of clips on Landism that I found. So this is... this is some BBC 4 documentary on Laddism, which I'll just play a little bit of.
Every action has an equal and opposite reaction. And all the people that instituted the New Ladd movement cut their teeth as journalists during the days of Red Wedge and the GLC and the real boom of left-wing thinking and ideology in the 80s, you know, the Billy Bragg and the Redskins and the SWP and anti-nuke marches, and it was a very active time, and you would, no, you can't call women birds anymore, no, it's sexist, and you were just trying to get your head around it. And in the end, there was so much for men to think about, they just thought, oh, bollocks to it.
For some, political correctness had seemed like a linguistic straitjacket. Bubbling just beneath the surface was a whole lexicon of sexist terms just waiting to get out. And in the mid-90s, they were unleashed with the coming of the New Ladd.
You can walk down the road, see a nice girl, and you go, bosh.
If they're a bit bish-bosh, tip-top, ding-dong, woof-woof, meow, then game on, Raymond.
Well, there's always birds, isn't it? It's always birds or Doris. Last night went out, had a few beers, had a curry, had a fight, as lads do. Oh, this bird went home and bossed her.
When New Laddism appeared, if it were movement at all, its main interest was in releasing the manacles of political correctness. So, you know, being happy to talk about sex, for example, in a vocabulary that didn't feel that you had to wear kid gloves to talk about it.
And it assumed that women had won, and it was sort of a rearguard action. You know, so it was built on the premise that women had got what they wanted, so they couldn't ever be insulted by people talking in this way or using this kind of language, because it was strictly understood that it was just for fun.
Men just having fun and using casual sexist terms was sweeping back into vogue. In 1994, a magazine came onto the market which celebrated the return of this type of male attitude. With its racy and witty use of language, Loaded was an overnight success.
It was really clear that there wasn't a magazine.
I'm interested as to why this took place or why it was allowed to take place, because clearly there is a market today for a backlash against political correctness once again. Okay, there is an entire economy on YouTube, for example, that we are all a part of. That is against PC, right? Yet the mainstream culture does not allow this to register. Whereas in this era, it absolutely, you know, it was absolutely everywhere. And I'm wondering, did that happen as a kind of form of containment, or like why did this happen? I still wonder about it, which is why I wanted to do this stream. Any thoughts, Simon?
Very much my view. It's all highly curated, I think. It's, you know, you even got a hint of it there where Badil's talking about the way that language is being framed in a sort of permitted way to allow this kind of what I was looking at when I was sort of leading up to this stream was looking at bits of the research or the polling research. And because around this time, they're saying, you know, Loaded comes out in about 94 and it had a gestation period of about a year. And I went and looked at the Guardian ICM polls for how the parties were doing in that space. And you just had the Tories getting a high of about 43% of the vote in the 92 election. And then, you know, within a few months, they're starting to slide down into the very low 30s. And you're then seeing that Labour is picking up quite quickly at that point. So by that time, I think you're seeing that Labour are sort of pretty determined to sort of make a comeback. And it feels like they're very much trying to reclaim and reconstruct this kind of median C2 kind of voter. Mm-hmm. But again, layer it all over the middle class. They need to just grab that floater voter section in the middle. And this is what interests me as why it's a constructed movement that needs to enlist the middle classes. And I was thinking when we talk about the football just then of asking you guys, were you conscious of the sort of change from, with football, for example? I mean, because when I was a kid in the 70s, it was very much a working class sport. But were you in a period where you were conscious of it actually being changed to sort of bring in, you know, the middle classes to say that this is something for you as well? This is something you can have ownership of.
Thomas?
Oh, yes, I certainly remember that time. It was definitely in the 90s. They put the prices up at football. And as Academic Agent referred to, the things like fantasy football definitely started a trend of making football a very middle class thing. So I certainly remember that. To go to the issue of why this stuff was pushed in the 90s, I personally think it was like a pre-runner to the sort of pornography and the sort of extreme hedonism that we see today. And of course, on the other hand, the other thing I think that things like this do is that they fuel a reaction which will lead people ultimately into false religions like feminism or leftism in general. And I wanted to put this question to both you guys. I mean, I don't want to defend feminists and I don't want to defend people on the left, but you can understand that I think anyway, like if you're a woman and you're looking at all of this stuff, I think it's quite distasteful, this sort of lad culture. You can understand why women who are sort of in the midwit bracket might then be tempted to find solace in something like feminism. And so I would put it that in some ways, this kind of thing from the 90s fuels the rise in feminism and the rise in SJWism. But I don't know what you guys think about that.
It maybe does, but it sort of packages masculinity, I think, in a way that has already got something that's undercutting it within it. You know, it's this thing of the buffoonishness. You know, I mean, I very much noticed when in the mid 90s, it was almost like over a period of a week or two, you really started to notice adverts creeping in where the guy was the kind of dolt or the buffoon in some way.
Yeah. And I've got a clip here. We might come back to this documentary in a second, but there was another show on Simon called Teachers. I don't know if you remember it. But it kind of captured this. There was almost like this feeling that the feminism had won, like the guy was saying, the rear guard action. But there's something a bit pathetic in it. Let's just have a look here at where a male teacher says no to the female headmistress. Let's just have a watch of this.
Sit. These are the amended schedules and timetables as promised. Sorry they're late. Please get to know them. Pupils wandering the corridors, gormlessly searching for classrooms we can cope with, but I'd like to avoid staff members doing the same. I'm also starting gate monitors for the beginning and end of school. Liz has very kindly drawn up a rota, and this week's lucky winners are Mr. McKenna and Mr. Keating.
Oh, I'm sorry, I can't do it tonight, Claire.
Sorry.
I'm expecting a delivery of videos for the languages lab. I don't want the valuable resources of the school sitting around unattended.
Fine. Referring down to the reserves. Simon.
I've got stuff on today too.
What, at the end of school?
Could be.
Put down Mr. Casey. Any more questions? Yes, Mr. McKenna. You wanted to say something?
No. Just looking forward to monitoring the gate.
Thank you, everyone.
So do you see what I mean? There's a kind of, you saw this in the, you saw this in Men Behaving Badly as well, with a kind of Pauline Quirk character there who is clearly like the adult in the room. And there's just something about the way they're positioned. They're almost like kids.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
You've got the headmaster sweeping in and, you know, she's the sort of classic ball breaker character, as you call it in American telly. And but you're still allowing the men to retain a sort of, they get a little bit of social credit for being kind of funny, you know, being kind of gormless, you know, in the scene. But you're left in no doubt that the message is that, you know, the girls are in charge, boys, and you better tighten up your act. But it feels again like this has all been, the whole lab thing is constructed slightly to give men a sort of get out, a sort of escape. They can still be kind of a little bit naughty, a bit boisterous. But ultimately, they're going to have to knuckle down because now there's a new sheriff in town. It reminds me of this. There's a saying in Sun Tzu, The Art of War, you build golden bridges for your enemies to retreat across, you know, so they don't lose face. And that's kind of what's happening in this period. I mean, I must say, I find a little bit of, it's kind of weird watching some of this stuff, because obviously coming from the time I did, the sort of masculine archetypes were pretty kind of balls out and unapologetic. And they weren't kind of self-conscious in this way. They weren't kind of slightly fey or slightly dopey or humorous. They were kind of pretty, pretty much, you know, sideburn chopped coppers from the Sweeney, you know, kicking in doors and saying you're nicked. I mean, this stuff is all kind of like, what am I watching? I'm watching these kind of panty waist men. It just doesn't,
They're all pathetic. I mean, there's an inbuilt patheticness to the new lads, which is kind of gloried in as well. It's kind of weird, like you're encouraged to be this now, which does make me wonder where, you know, because they're not exactly making Sargon-esque critiques of feminism, are they? They're just kind of having a petulant rebellion, if you want.
It's like you're saying to them, we'll let you get off, lads, with a bit of bad behavior because we're going to make you the heel in this show.
Yeah.
I would Thomas? Also, yes, I would also say, you know, in my youth and certainly in the 90s and then after that, there was a preponderance of tough female characters, the ball breaker, as Simon referred to this woman here. And that, I certainly had the impression growing up that women like to be dominant and that it was, you know, you should always sort of like dominant women and you should always sort of pander to them. And of course, this is another one of those television tropes that you find out in, you know, when you try to enact it in reality, you find it is it's the absolute opposite. And, you know, by being misled by what you learnt on the television, it leads you into all sorts of calamities in real life. So this is something that sort of has to be unlearned.
Yeah, I mean, in reality, women do resent being pushed into dominant positions, especially in a romantic relationship. They're repulsed by it. They're repulsed by being forced to be dominant. If that makes any sense.
I completely agree.
I'm sure people learn that the hard way, as I have done.
Oh yes, me too, on many occasions.
Let's carry on watching this BBC documentary, see what else they say.
That was reflecting what was going on in Britain in the early 90s. There weren't any significant club magazines, there weren't really any cutting edge football magazines. Men's magazines tended to be about some sort of beautiful Thatcherite lifestyle, Armani coats, Church's shoes and Range Rovers. And most of the guys I knew were wearing jeans, Ben Sherman's.
There you go, Ben Sherman's.
clubs, going to football, going to festivals, and it was really just to create a magazine that reflected that.
They had a particular house style, and because they were shocking, and if you're shocking, you get lots of attention, and if you get attention, you get sales. The other magazines panicked and thought, we've got to copy them if we want to get on, and they all had busty blocks.
Now, did any of you guys ever buy Loaded or FHM or anything like this? Because I even back then, I thought all of this was fake, but and that only the fakest people would try to lean into this. I mean, I had one friend, incidentally, the same friend who would sell out his grandmother to be with the cool kids, also bought copies of FHM and pretended to fancy Gail Porter, but I always thought he was full of shit. Did you ever buy FHM, Thomas?
Absolutely not. It's funny what you say, though, that you thought that your friend was full of shit. I certainly never bought these things or wanted to buy into this culture. But I would say that the kids at my school who did buy into this, you know, FHM and did, you know, they were to be seen in the sixth form common room, you know, looking through FHM. I would say that, in my opinion, these kids were quite chaddish. I didn't sense that they were fake. So I mean, that's that. I wanted to raise one point, which is that in some ways, I think that stuff like FHM is worse. They were worse than porn mags in the sense that people would read FHM in public, whereas no one would ever do that with a porn mag. And at least in my eyes, that makes pornography, you know, it redeems it slightly in comparison to this sort of open FHM stuff where people would read it, you know, in front of everyone.
Yeah, incidentally, if you have a look at the thumbnail for this show, famously, Gail Porter appeared on the front of FHM with her back to the camera, if you want, so you could see her ass, essentially. And that image was then beamed onto the Houses of Parliament. And then years later, I remember Gail Porter... Something happened to her? Did she get cancer or something? Because she was bald, I remember.
She had alopecia, yeah. She just lost all her hair.
And she claimed to have been traumatized by the fact that her, you know, full body was beamed onto the House of Commons. So make of that what you will. But she, like, how can I put it? She both rode this... and then rode the wave of feminism in the early 2010s, as David Baddiel did. David Baddiel rode the new laddism, and then now he's a full SJW. So it's funny how that happens, isn't it?
I have to say about these magazines, actually, I mean, I never sort of bought these things. I mean, you know, if you wanted pornography, just go and get Honest Pornography, if you like. But I did. There's one thing I recall now. There was a weird thing I noticed. These friends of mine who worked in new media, they were a married couple living in, you know, Maidervale in a sort of nice-ish flat with their kids. And they would have copies of this stuff lying around. It was almost like it was kind of bought de rigueur to be seen on your coffee table as a kind of sort of, you know, signal of hipness in some way. I mean, I think they probably read some of the articles or something, but I don't imagine they sort of lingered over the sort of Dolly Bird pictures or anything like that. But they were very visible, I remember, in people's flats and houses, as if this was the stuff to be looking at. But it's kind of mystifying, really, because there was no reason for them to, you know, have this stuff. But I suppose it was just thought to be the kind of, you know, it was, when you look at a lot of the magazines like Loaded, FHM, Maxim, and all of that stuff, it was all kind of based basically in subjectivity focused gonzo journalism. So maybe occasionally they'll have some good article about, you know, what it's like to be a serial killer or something like that.
I wonder if Julie Birchall ever wrote for FHM. I bet Birchall was knocking around at this era. She must have been. Yeah. She must have had some new laddism gig at some point.
She was writing for The Guardian magazine, the weekend magazine mostly at that time, and she was doing a lot of coke, apparently.
Oh, I see. I have to admit that during this era, the only magazine, like youth magazines, that I would ever read were the girly mags of whatever girlfriend I had, and as most lads of this era, I would just beeline to the problem section. It would be like, dear sugar, you know, I can't make my boyfriend come, what shall I do, you know, because they were filth. Those pages were absolutely way more filthy than anything you'd find in FHM. It'd be like, you know, techniques on various different things. So yeah, those are the only bits of interest to me at this era. Okay, let's see what else they say.
On the occasional brunette in a tight-fitting push-up bikini on the front cover, and inside it was all about your personal organizer and your car.
What we were doing as well was we were using a lot of our favorite phrases from comedy and putting it into the magazine and using them as headlines and section headers. So we used to plunder the fashion.
Can I just say, the documentary arty BBC4 super close-up of the hand is driving me nuts. Why are they doing that? Why are they doing super close-ups of these talking heads? It's irritating me.
Go before the fascia ran for a couple of series before anyone really noticed it. So we used, for instance, Scorchio, which was their Channel 9 spoof foreign news show.
Monte Blanco, Scorchio, Costa, Scorchio, Meteorologico is mañana. Oh, Scorchio.
Butros Gali. Butros Gali.
As well as Good Work Fella, we had a counter column where we were slagging stuff off called Bunch of Arse.
I think that's terribly funny. A bunch of arse. How can you have a bunch of arse? And yet there's a kind of delicious creativity about putting those words together.
And people thought we'd invented that. And we wasn't. It came from a Basil Fawlty line in Fawlty Towers, where Basil Fawlty goes, bunch of grapes, that's a bunch of arse.
Tell him if he doesn't get on the ball, you're going to bust his ass.
You know, I still think one of my chief theses that I've pushed on my channel is the idea that we were already in the ashes before. Like, people think, oh, it's a recent... I think this is the absolute ashes here. Not Fawlty Towers, but this whole culture of glorifying the phrase bunch of arse, for example. What is this?
Bust his ass! All that! And two green salads.
Here we are. One green salad and one Mordo salad.
I thought yes.
There's another dominant woman, by the way. This one, this time from the 70s, but Sybil was a battle axe.
Oh, would you excuse me one moment?
Do you hear me? It's not good enough. It's got
salad. These were our icons. The Happy Mondays, Harry Enfield, The Fast Show, Basil Fawlty. They were the people that were affecting the tone of voice and the actual words that we used. The one word that we definitely reintroduced into the printed word as a description of women was bird. But, you know, I'd spent 4 or 5 years.
In a strange way, this whole thing feeds into a lot of I know you've made a few videos on Britisher, Thomas. But there's quite a bit of this feeds into his whole worldview in a way, which is built on the back of like comedy icons and, you know. And this is something that you cannot really build a worldview on comedy, and yet this was a kind of standard thing that people did a lot, and I still think liberals do it now, where you essentially inherit your political and social attitudes from, you know, comedians.
Yes, I'd absolutely agree with that. And you can see people like the Britisher, he always defaults to, you know, his comedies, you know, the Two Ronnies or Monty Python or whatever it is. But also, you know, people today, they have this idea that, you know, they use things like Have I Got News For You to inform their politics. They use things like Spitting Image to inform their politics. And ultimately, I think once you've got red-pilled, you realize that all these things are very, very hollow and shallow. And as you said before, when you were referring to, you know, Fawlty Towers from 1970s, and I absolutely agree with this, we were already in the ashes back then.
Yeah. Any thoughts, Simon?
Yeah, I agree. We were just working it through with these kinds of comedies as well. I mean, throughout the 70s, you had all these kind of sort of men in crisis in a way, like Basil Fawlty's a classic character, but even, you know, the Alf Garnetts of the world or Reggie Perrin, you know, they're all kind of collapsing in some way. So that's kind of further kind of, you know, grinding in that sort of message. Funny thing about that clip, though, was looking at James Brown, the guy who founded Loaded there, talking in that very conscious way about, you know, we decided to do this. You know, it's very, very particular, very specific and manipulative sort of tone that you sort of pick up off him. And I also wonder about this time, you get a little bit of... you got this with Blair and you got this with Brown there, that thing of starting to drop your accent a little bit into the estuary, you know, football, that kind of thing.
They love doing that. There's a kind of borrowed authenticity of having a regional accent.
Exactly.
Yeah. Let's see what else this happens here.
Around with rock bands and there's some birds outside. Or are there any birds? You know, it was just a phrase that was in use. Amongst that mainly.
Who decided? There's a cameraman who decided, right, shot straight up the nose. Balagarty on BBC Four. Fucking twat.
Male, you know, rock and club culture.
The laddishness is a real way of bang, making a splash. Rather than being calm, considered, and thinking about things, burn all the rule books and just do what the fuck you like.
She get it. She can have it.
Out on the pull. I turn around, look at my mate, and go, nice.
It's a minky. Yeah, minky.
Yeah, if you had done a bit of DIY, what would you use, Black and Decker or a Bosch? If they say Bosch, you're in X, then everyone's not going for the Black.
It is a very low effort thing to ask young men to buy into, though. It's very easy to slip into this, I think. I don't know how much of it is performative and how much of it is natural, but like, it is very easy for young men to pull this off, I would say. Because there's like an almost like ready-made... You know, I was always interested in the idea of the Spice Girls giving young women 5 personality types to choose from off the shelf. You know, you can either be sporty Spice or scary Spice or, you know, it's like a kind of ready-made, a ready-made personality for you. But isn't that what the laddism is as well? This is like saying, well, you can have this personality, you know, and you can feel safe and at home in that. Bit of banter, lads, hey?
Yeah, and it gives you a series of speech codes to kind of, you know, try and enforce that with. But the banter never feels very natural to me. It's certainly not what I'm used to anyway, which is quite sort of savage military level banter, which I'm not sure that's what laddism was about. It's about more to be seen to be keeping up with the kind of referencing. You know, I wonder if this is again part of a sort of a Gen X thing, that thing that we're talking about with the comedy of using this tethering to a sort of cozy nostalgia in some way. And this is part of building up a kind of folklore.
It feels fake, right? But what fascinates me is that none of these men will... What we're watching on this little documentary thing is the success of the... You know, you were saying he was thinking very carefully about what he put into Loaded there. But we're seeing the success of the top down kind of conditioning
prescription,
because people then act it out and perform it in real life.
It's the way you say it. It's minky.
Probably the best place for lad stuff is Roger's Profanosaurus, that wonderful dictionary brought out by Viz. Great stuff. I mean, obsessed with farting and with defecation, with urination, and all this kind of stuff. Because basically what it is, it's a bunch of lads, 4 in the morning, blind drunk, emailing some bollocks into Viz, and good luck to them.
As an outsider, when you come into any group, they've got nicknames, code, passwords, and all these different things to communicate with each other. And you automatically feel quite excluded. But when you're in on it, you feel, right, part of the gang. It's the most childish aspect of the whole new lad thing, is it's no different to boys against girls in the playground, all in for war. It's that, just with tits.
And a lot of people say slapper. I think it means bird, you know, woman.
A general term for birds, isn't it?
Totty, nice minge.
Sometimes you just go out and get mullet and you want some minky.
I am mullet for minky.
And these aggressive terms for going out and looking for members of the opposite sex, on the pull, on the sniff, but then you get out trouting. And sharking.
You can say you're sharking women.
Sharking. I only ever heard sharking on an album by The Streets. I don't even remember them. They were like a kind of... Well, it was just one bloke, a kind of British rap guy. He used the terminology sharking.
Girls shark, men just go on the prowl. Put my arm round and dribble in her ear.
Particularly, you come back again and again with the new lads to the language of mating rituals and the language of women, and you get a whole lot of words, very unpleasant sexist words, swamp donkey, munter, Nora, Doris.
Munter was very much used in my neck of the woods.
Doris, dragon, all these words for unattractive women, women you don't want to know.
Minga was probably dominant in Wales. She's a bit of a minga.
And only a few words like oof is a good one. Oof, meaning a really attractive bird, you know, real top totty.
A bit of top totty.
It's a bit of top totty, a bit of arse.
A bit of totty.
Bit of totty.
A bit of girlish totty.
Bit of girlish totty, my babber. Where's that to you, my darling?
Give
it a big good.
There are hundreds of words for being drunk in new lad slang. Words like langered, mullered, moosed out, faced.
Going out of the lash, getting pissed.
So I don't know about you, but I just find it extraordinarily cringe. What are you guys thinking while watching this?
Yeah, a bunch of wankers. Sorry.
I mean, it's difficult. Like, it's kind of difficult. If you were a young woman growing up around this, what would you? It'd be very easy then to turn up at university and go wild for like Judith Butler, for example, because so much of this is fake as well and constructed as we're seeing here. So yeah, it's then very easy to deconstruct it.
And I think some of the lads there who were doing that, I think they were just putting it on for the cameras. You know, they were saying things that were expected of them. But to go back to what the purpose of all this might be, another thing that this does is that it draws a huge wedge between the sexes, and especially intelligent women are put off by this kind of thing. And, you know, if we ever get to talk about the ladette culture, intelligent men are put off by that. And so you get this rank division between intelligent men and intelligent women, and they end up, you know, not being able to stand each other. And I think in any decent society, although we shouldn't be politically correct and we should allow things like banter, it's also very important to have a sort of modesty code. And so that, you know, what is talked about in the public sphere is very much neutral, you know, and how can I say it's chivalrous in respect to the opposite sex, so that you don't end up with this wedge between the sexes.
But you see, this kind of slightly disrespectful attitude towards women didn't actually exist in the patriarchal culture.
No.
You know, the Victorian culture, for example, or the, or even like 1950s culture or 1920s culture. You know, there were all these codes around courting and around how to behave. And, you know, a woman was expected to play a little bit hard to get, and a man, you know, had his kind of playbook as well. And this wisdom was passed down. But all of these people, if you think about it in a different way, this is the result of the kind of ground zero of the 60s, doing away with all of that, doing away with all the sex codes, doing away with, and this is the result. People basically not really knowing how to behave, and then you know, the result is this, which is, frankly, abhorrent, really. If you think from a kind of right wing analysis, would be like this. Well, this is obviously not good behavior from anybody. Yeah.
No, absolutely. And you wouldn't want your daughter, you know, any man wouldn't want his daughter. Like, I wouldn't want my daughter looking at this kind of stuff and thinking that this was men. You know, anyone who has, you know, daughters will understand that in today's culture, there is often this false dilemma offered to women, whereby they either become sort of Kim Kardashian Instagram whore, or they go into something else, and that something else is sort of feminism. So again, I'm not trying to defend feminists, but I can see why this sort of culture, you know, helps to fuel feminism and the rise of the left.
Yeah, people are saying that women were just as bad and that they tried to outdo the men and things. Now, I definitely remember the ladette, you know. I mean, I remember in university, you know, some of those girls would play rugby and they'd drink pints and they'd, you know, they were quite thick, you know, thickly built. You know, they looked like they could pack a punch as well if they wanted to. So there was a kind of masculine, there was kind of like a masculinized woman as well around this time. And that was captured in the culture by Zoe Ball and various other Ledettes. Who were the other Ledettes?
Sarah Cox, I think.
Sarah Cox. Denise Van Outen, if you remember her.
Yes.
She was a bit sexier, but still, she was kind of on the Ledette end. Mm. And they all had those accents that you were talking about, where they dropped their H's on occasion or whatever else. There was a show on called The Big Breakfast that was kind of there was a guy Johnny on there Vaughan. Called Johnny Vaughan. He was kind of a node of Laddism. And there was also Chris Evans's TFI Friday. That was a kind of staple of Britpop and Laddism on there. Very, very lagery, very laddie. But also the girls would get involved, like the girls would banter too type thing. They'd go for boys they fancied and pinch their asses and so on, which is entirely unnatural behavior for women. Mm. You know, Judy Bertram must have been in her element in that kind of atmosphere.
I didn't see too much of it myself in terms of the girls I knew, in terms of the sort of Ladette thing. But I think certainly the culture at the time, it gave, there were some women who felt they could be let off the leash in terms of, you know, generally dissipated lifestyle. I mean, and a lot of them I can see. I mean, there were either those who would lean very heavily into feminism. I think my girlfriend at the time did, I'm afraid. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the way that kind of panned out is in the end, they end up breaking up the relationship because they try to make themselves repulsive to you as part of their sense of empowerment. And on the flip side of that, there were girls who were just, I think, looking to get sort of, you know, social traction in the sort of dating game, and they felt that they could be a lot, let's say, a lot freer, if you like, than they might have been, a little more retiring in the 70s and the 80s and looking for something romantic. This was something where girls took it upon themselves to be the sort of the accruing sexual power in their image, you know, and they were leaning more into the kind of the feisty woman thing rather than the Ladette. They didn't want to sort of throw all caution to the winds, but they wanted to be somehow seen as a little bit more dangerous and exciting and a bit less of a wallflower.
Yeah, I saw more of the Ladettes in university than at school, I have to admit. The girls in my school were more on the girly end, I think. But certainly in university, I saw much more of it. Thomas, did you witness any real-life Ladettes?
You know what? I can't say that I did. I was generally just intimidated by the average woman, you know, especially when I was at university. And I mean, because there was, you know, the university, you get a lot of very sexy women. They're also often very intelligent, you know, in an academic sense. And they're often very, you know, they've got some level of money. And you would, you know, they would get at the weekend, they'd go off with, 30-year-old boyfriends who had cars. And so I was very intimidated by these women. But I have to say, I didn't know. I think the Ladette culture thing was something I saw on the television, but never so much in real life. The other thing I was going to say is that you start a sort of arms race between the sexes, and this probably goes back to the 50s or something. But what happens is that women might see men, or they'll see on the television men going to a strip club to, you know, cheer at a stripper. And so they want to take revenge. And so women will have their sort of their hen night where they go out and they get a stripper. And then men don't like that. So men react and say, no, we're going to do something. And so you have this sort of arms war between the sexes where they each try to do something more hedonistic in order to sort of own the opposite sex. And ultimately it leads to a terrible division and really poor relations between the sexes.
Now, somebody has just, that is an obscure but 10 out of 10 reference in the chat there. Emily Booth, she was a bit of all right, wasn't she? What was that show she presented? Bits, was it? Video game show. She was fit though, Emily Booth. See if I can pull up a picture of her. I don't expect you guys to have to remember her, but she was that was an interesting show that was on while I was at university, kind of early 2000s. Sometimes I'd watch a bit of that. But anyway, let us now watch a little bit of Game On, which I think, again, a lot of these shows, if we really think about what's going on, show masculinity in crisis, despite the facade of laddism in the way. Game On was about a three. So this, as you'll see, there are three characters here: Martin, Matthew, who is the landlord, and was her name Mandy? Mandy was this girl here who was a bit of a slag, to be honest. And they lived in this flat together, but Matthew, despite his hard man image, had agoraphobia and never left the flat and was a massive nerd. Yet he bullied Martin a lot. Now, I kind of like some of the misanthropy in the show, to the extent that I'd love to recreate it with Daughter of Albion as Mandy, me as Matthew, and Not So Obvious as Martin. But that's a story for another day. Let's have a watch of this.
But Sunday morning is only for the blessed and the sacred moments of silliness.
I should mention that this actor here, Ben Chapman, was replaced in the second series by a much less good-looking man. And I thought that the show didn't work as well because they made him like too pathetic. Even though this version of the character is equally as pathetic, the dynamic works a bit better because he's obviously better looking than Martin. But anyway, let's carry on. I'll also say that Samantha Janis was fit as well. See, look at that. The laddism has rubbed off on me. And now I'm just openly talking about how fit birds are. But there we are.
Oh, sorry. I was looking for someone called Amanda Wilkins.
I am she.
Oh, well, look. I'm Matthew Cruikshank, the chairman. You write James's letters, yes?
Oh, God, is the spelling wrong?
No, far from it. You have a mean way with a semicolon.
Well, thanks.
Yes, you know the difference between infer and imply.
What are you implying?
I'd like to take a hunch on you, Amanda. How would you like to edit the new fiction list?
Well, I think...
Oh, there would be a directorship, of course. A company car, a profit share.
Wardrobe allowance.
$10,000.
Bacon sandwiches.
Anytime you want one.
Yeah, she was a bit educating Rita, this character, in general. Well, that was her basic dream, but...
Well, what do I look like?
You look like a big shape obscuring my view of a very interesting television programme.
It's a programme about building a rockery.
I'm interested in it.
Come off it. You're not interested in gardening. You wouldn't even let me get a window box.
I had my reasons.
Oh, yeah, I remember them. I don't like all that soil and outside shit.
Man, just get out of the way. I feel peculiar when I haven't got a clear view of the television.
What do I look like?
You look nice, man. You look like a girly. What do you expect?
A nice girly. £200 this? I'm just not achieving, am I?
Well, what do you want to achieve?
I don't know. I just, you know, want to get on. I mean, I've got 3 A's at A level. I've got an upper second. I've got a 4-figure overdraft and I'm still doing shit work.
Never mind, man. Have a cup of tea. Cup of tea for Mand, Mart.
Hey, Mand. I'd make a good geisha girl, wouldn't I? The amount of tea I make. Mand?
Yes, I heard you. Very funny, ha ha ha.
Sorry.
using a very, very cold...
Matt? I think Mandy's upset about something.
On the blob, mate.
What?
On the blob. Having her period. Women get weird when they're on their blobs. And before it. And after it sometimes. Let's just ignore it.
I mean, without wanting to be too laddie, I have often thought that women do spend essentially 3 weeks out of every four just fucking mental. How does that work? How do they even get through life? Anyway.
I hate a woman. All that sticky, smelly stuff.
Shut up, Matt. I've only just had my dinner.
God, sorry, mate. I forgot.
All right. Maybe that's aged a little bit better than some of the others. I don't know. I always thought Game On was kind of interesting because it was a little bit more self-conscious about what was going on, but it still kind of played into those tropes a little bit as well. But I thought it may you can see a bit more of the fakery because obviously this guy never goes out. So he's just kind of putting on a persona. I do have a couple, just two more clips that I want to play. This is In Defense of Lag Culture by The Guardian in 2015. So I'm intrigued as to why The Guardian were running this. Let's see what his arguments in defense of lag culture are.
I love being a man. I love sport, beers, and banter. I've catcalled, I've wolf whistled, I've sung songs like I wish that all the ladies were buns in the oven. And I was a baker, I'd cream them by the dozen. And these things were fun. I got a laugh out of my mates. A sense of belonging. Being one of the boys is a truly fantastic thing. Traditionally, when we talk about sexism, we point the finger at men as only being the problem. This has to stop. It is true that there are some serious issues with lag culture.
If you know the trick to getting the bra off quickly, she's yours. Turn around and lift up your fucking shirt.
But what about all the great things? The camaraderie, the fun, the friendships? If you only tell guys that lag culture is bad, stop it. They'll say, hey, it's not all bad. You don't know what you're talking about. And thus, rightfully, most of us are just going to ignore you and keep doing what we're doing. But when I speak to all my mates individually, none of them value sexism, misogyny, objectifying women. So why does our group become sexist, despite none of its members being sexist? In the competition to get respect from our mates, we actually do the one thing that none of our mates respect. It was exactly this realization that led us to establish the Good Lad Initiative at the University of Oxford. We run workshops with men to discuss issues of
masculinity. I might have known that there'd be an agenda from the Guardian.
Sex and lad culture. But why should we care about a little bit of banter? Well, it's because these cultural norms are the platform for much more serious violence. One in three teenage girls has experienced sexual violence from a boyfriend. One in seven female university students has experienced serious sexual assault or serious physical violence. Why?
Wonder if Sargon actually has a video, because this is from 2015 and seems to be prime Sargon 2015 material. But
at university, to solve this problem requires all of us, both men and women, by having open discussions and embracing positive masculinity. We can begin to shift cultural norms towards the good men that we naturally are.
So what did, like to do all of- what did you make of that? Any thoughts, Simon?
It's like it sort of comes into sharper relief, doesn't it? It does feel like that it was set up as a deliberate... I have my theory about this. I think, you look at the magazines, a lot of them were... this is going to sound a circuitous route to get to an answer. A lot of them were actually run by IPC, which is a subsidiary of the Mirror Group. So a lot of this stuff was actually coming from a place on the left in terms of publishing. And this when we're talking about ladders and being constructed, you're seeing there that that's the kind of end stage of the process there. They're saying, well, look, that's what being a ladder is about. But now we should really think about it deeper, because it's a slippery slope for this to turn into something really nasty, isn't it? It's kind of giving you the bad example and then saying, well, that's all just a bit of fun. But actually, we need to talk about the serious issues underneath. And that's the kind of that's the way they sort of get at you. At that stage. And I think that would make sense, that, you know, that would be the Guardian ostensibly trying to say, no harm in a bit of banter, but when it gets serious, it leads to rape or something like that, you know.
And consider as well that the left do believe in the Hegelian dialectic as a kind of pattern of history, you know, where you get, action, reaction, synthesis.
Exactly.
So, if you think about the way this narrative plays out, the kind of PC alternative 80s culture that Phil Jupiter was talking about, then the reaction engineered by Phil Jupiter and friends, and David Baddiel randomly, and then the new synthesis, which was that video that we watched. It does feel like it almost too contrived to play out in that pattern.
Culturally, it does seem like the equivalent of throwing a brick through somebody's window, getting them scared, and then coming to their door the next day to sell them a burglar alarm.
Yes, indeed. It reminds me, it's a bit like saying we need communism because capitalism is so bad. I think all these people, they don't know, their moral compass is all over the place. And so they can't criticize lad culture without falling head over heels into feminism. They're seeing it as a kind of dichotomy, a false dilemma.
Yeah, no, I actually think it's just the total absence of norms, essentially. Both the laddism and the feminism are reactions to, the uprooting of those norms around courting and dating that existed for decades and centuries before the free love of the '60s cultural revolution. In fact, I even had a view that the Me Too movement was the kind of logical endpoint of that, really, because, without wanting to sound left wing in any sense, I do think there's something a bit rapey about 60s free love culture, and something a bit leery about the laddism. Those things are true, are they not?
Yes, I'd absolutely agree. I mean, I don't want a white knight for feminists, and I don't take a lot of these Me Too claims seriously. But it's certainly true what you're saying, that, you know, a lot of the degeneracy in morals has given the feminists some sort of traction in their sort of claims.
Yeah. So, I mean, my thought is that men. I mean, maybe there's some truth that men will veer towards banter and something that looks like laddism if left. So culture needs to give young men a set of kind of firm guidelines, which I think were almost totally lacking when I was a teenager. My dad's equivalent of like advice was, what did he say? Be like the butterfly, go from flower to flower. That was his advice to me. I mean, it's like, okay, great. But that's not exactly like kind of, you know, the kind of gentleman's handbook that they'd get in the 1890s or something. So, yes. In fact, I went looking for advice that they used to give to young men and young women, and not only did they give advice for how to behave during the courting process, but they also gave advice for how to behave as a husband and as a wife as well, which, as someone who's been divorced once and is well on the way to a second one, I'm joking, that would have been useful to have. But you don't really get that. You don't really get that advice. I mean, the most advice you get from male figures in your life is something along the lines of, if you want my advice, don't get married. or similar, right? I mean, I don't, maybe I just have bad role models or something, but I feel like you really don't get any guidance.
I certainly felt like that too growing up. I felt like nobody had any moral guidance to give, and it was just a plethora of sort of nihilistic nonsense and trash that you saw on the television. And if you ever picked anyone up on this and said, aren't we supposed to live by some kind of religion or some kind of moral code, you were soon looked at as if you were a complete weirdo. So for me growing up, there was never any sort of moral counsel.
Yeah. Something very inhibitive about lad culture as well, in the way, as I say, it's being expressed where the man always becomes the heel, and where the female response is always kind of skeptical or disapproving. At best, it's a contrast. Again, I go back to those old kind of masculine archetypes of the 70s, and I think of things like, you know, Jack Regan in The Sweeney with his girlfriend in bed and she's wearing like an SS helmet, and you think there was a kind of a thing about what the messaging there is, you know, the women like you to be a bit naughty and do all kinds of, you know, so it's this, as I say, there's the sense of a frowning femininity that comes through all of this, and you know, boys have to be sort of kept in check. But as Thomas is saying, there is no sort of positive guidance about this, and I'm aware of a generation of young men, you know, from my generation onwards, who have felt kind of adrift and have felt, you know, more that it's, they know what they're not supposed to do, but there's no sense in which they're being invited to become themselves, to self-actualize as men. And of course, you suspect, of course, that women want the same kind of thing, but all of the social messaging mitigates against the explicit performance of that. And laddism was a sort of way of creating an artificial last hurrah that could then be, you know, duffed up later in culture, and as you say, lead to the acceleration of you know, feminism and Me Too and all of that stuff.
Yeah, and all of the British comedy shows that we're thinking of as well, all the ones that we've mentioned and more, you only really get to two archetypes of wife as well, which is the long-suffering, tutting wife, you know, or the dragon, you know, the Sybil Fawlty or like Gary's wife and Men Behaving Badly, essentially, or like bloody Cassandra or something in Only Fools, or you know, Nora Batty or whatever. Like, you only get the dragon or the tutter. You don't get, like, I don't know, the good wife or the loving wife, or, you know, she's always put upon in some way that I can think of.
And on a similar note, I would say, if we go back to that what was it, the show you just showed last, I can't remember the name, Game On. Yes, the two men in that are both a bunch of, I don't like either of them. The sensitive and intelligent guy is portrayed as being very wet and weak and hopeless. Yes. And then the other guy, who's a bit more masculine, is just portrayed as being a jerk. So there's no middle ground, or, you know, compromise between those two sorts of characters.
And it's just sheer implausibility as well. I mean, I can't imagine being in a sort of nice house in London with a girl like that, and not just trying to have sex with her, to be honest, in the nicest possible way, if you see what I mean. But you know, Ginger No Chin has obviously got no chance, and the other guy could be in with a chance if only he wasn't a bedwetter.
Oh, I mean, if you watch that show, he is genuinely pathetic, though, because he's an agoraphobe, so he doesn't leave the house. There's one episode where they've both gone to work. You know, he's like a... he works in a Halifax or something, and you know, she works in a retail store, but they're both out, and Matthew just has nothing to do. In one episode, he kind of dresses up in army gear and you know, tries to camouflage himself behind the sofa. In another episode, he sneaks into a room and is trying on all her underwear and things. You know, so he is really pathetic. And there's one episode I seem to remember where she has a big black boyfriend who comes home, who just kind of dominates him and puts his arm around him, which is a little bit subversive now that I think about it. But yeah, it's kind of an interesting show to look back on that. One reason I have a fonder memory of Game On than some of the other shows of this era is just because of the relentless hierarchy in that show, where it's obvious that neither of the two men have any chance whatsoever with her, and where there's a, you know, Martin gets relentlessly bullied by both of them, and yeah, I kind of like that. But and yes, she does. She does indeed seem to always have a black boyfriend in it. All right. Any other last minute comments on this before I hit the super chats?
I've certainly got a few more things to say. I mean, can I just say, going back to that Talking Heads documentary, I just wanted to mention that I can't stand those things where you get all these sort of smug Talking Heads, you know, they're all on one of these documentaries and they all talk about how they invented comedy or how they changed culture. I really can't stand the smugness of those things. But I will also say the other point I wanted to mention is that all of what we're doing now would have been unthinkable 20 years ago. And 20 years ago, you used to have to watch these things and just basically agree because you didn't have any option.
It was a monoculture, in very much so. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
I can't believe there was nothing else to watch.
There was literally nothing else on.
Yeah. It all seems so lame, though. I'm just surprised at how badly a lot of it's dated. And I'm just more convinced that the whole sort of spasm of laddism was a kind of crafted episode to bring over a kind of lot of middle class voters to a sort of, you know, C2 culture, which is mm-hmm. what was being aimed at by the Labour Party, which is on the ascendant at this moment and sort of looking to grab a kind of image of, you know, male authenticity, but at the same time, one that is being cowed deliberately. You know, it's been implanted with these, it's been seeded with these messages of, yeah, we can let you be a little bit out of control here, but ultimately, you know, we want you to get with the Cathedral's program at this stage and start to sort of tone down this stuff a bit so you can perform it in this kind of harmless way. You can read your girly mags, but it all renders men as kind of sort of infantile, ultimately.
Yeah, it kind of overgrown children essentially that, you know, are just kind of bumbling through, but they have nothing but their, you know, their mates and their lager, essentially.
It's slightly desperate and slightly sort of supplicant to women as well, in a way that I'm seeing, especially in that Game On thing, where, you know, as you say, the you suspect these guys they're not going to make it, you know, in that sense, you know, they're just going to be the kind of detritus of a much more assertive, you know pro-feminine culture, but again, a pro-feminine culture that wants to have its cake and eat it.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting that she in that clip that I played was dreaming really of her career more than anything else. You see if I can find that clip of her bringing the black boyfriend home. That might be interesting to watch. Another long running joke in Game On is that he had this surfboard, but obviously he doesn't leave the flat, so he would never. He just whacks it for no particular reason. Just so I'll find that in a second because it might just be interesting to watch that scene. But yeah, I did watch Eurotrash. That was part of it. Eurotrash was quite fun, though. It's quite funny.
Eurotrash was hilarious. I'll give it that.
It was funny because they put the, it'd be like, you know, some German pervert with a Northern accent, or, you know, Japanese guy shagging a pot noodle with a Scouser. Scouse accent on it, you know, such a bizarre thing.
Ironically, it probably was the most entertaining show at the time, but it was absolute ashes as well.
It was like, well, absolute ashes without doubt, but quite good, especially if you're a teenager in 1997 or whenever it was. I mean, the thing that struck me looking at all the clips and, you know, especially Men Behaving Badly, I feel like Men Behaving Badly has dated the most badly out of all of them. But is the sheer fakery of it all. The fear that it just feels so contrived. And yet I remember living through it and thinking that it was very real and accurately reflected the culture. So I find that very strange looking back on it. The familiar has been made to feel strange for me.
It's amazing how much that's true of many sort of television programs that I watched when I was young, which I thought were really good and really somehow on the ball. And you look back later on in life and you think, oh, that's really, I really couldn't watch that anymore.
I don't know if you caught my video on American Beauty, which seems to have been algo randomly by YouTube, which never happens, but I can tell because there's non-regulars in the, there's just ran, I can tell there's random like normies in my comments. But I had, I mean, I loved American Beauty in 1999, but I absolutely hated it watching it again. And it felt so contrived as well, felt so fake. And yet, the, if I was to say the defining feature of American Beauty was its realism. So, yes, it's funny that. Let's just watch this clip of this black guy coming in and we'll do some super chats.
Stop mucking about, Matthew. Who was it?
I don't know. It's Barry or something.
Matthew, I don't know anyone called Barry. Why can't you just write messages down like Martin?
Whose flat is this anyway? Whose phone is it? Do you realise it's getting worn out with all these people ringing up for a shag with Mandy Wilkins?
I'm sorry nobody rings you, Matthew.
I expect Brad Freebird Rivers rings him.
And I'm sorry you had to answer the phone and that it was somebody for me, but will you please, please just tell me who it was?
Oh, calm down, woman. Give me a headache. What's your thing with you going on? Yeah, I remember it. It was some northerner. He only had the nerve to try and start a conversation with me. How are you then, mate? I don't know where you find him, man. I really don't.
And did he, by any chance, happen to disclose his identity?
What?
Who was it?
I don't know what his name was. It was something northern. Like Arthur Black Pudding, something like that.
It wasn't something like Paul Johnson, was it?
I suppose it could have been. Yeah, that was probably it.
Paul Johnson? Oh, my God, I can't believe it!
Who is he then, man? Is he nice?
Oh, he's wonderful. He's the most beautiful man I've ever seen. I only met him on Friday. I never thought he'd ring me.
I don't know why. You're an opportunity not to be missed.
Oh, do you think so? Thanks, Matt.
Only because you've got Easy Lay written all over you.
Paul's a boxer, by the way.
Oh, is he? Hey, Paul Johnson. He's not Paul the Rage Johnson, is he? Oh, don't be so thick, Martin.
Yeah, that's him. The Rage.
But Mandy, he's black.
Is he? Oh, shit, I wish he'd told me.
Funny, he didn't sound black.
What did he sound like?
Northern. Ugly.
He's ever so famous. He's always been photographed with Page Three girls. Hey, Matt. If he's going out with Mandy, do you think he'd let us have a go with some of his spares? If we begged him, sort of thing.
Hold on. This is really sad.
We don't beg from black northern boxers.
Don't we? Oh, Matt, I just want a girl. Any girl. I'd love her. Even one of the Rage's rejects, I'd give her a good loving.
Martin, shape up. Be like me, man. Stay cool. Wax your board. Wait for your wave. The big Wednesday. When the time is right, the girl will come to you. I wonder what he sees in Mandy anyway. I'd rather have a Page Three girl than Mandy any day of the week.
But you haven't really got a choice, though, have you? Not like Paul the Rage Johnson.
Yeah, well, you better not muck her around. I mean, he may be famous, yeah, but I do not want him coming round here, lording it over us and upsetting Mandy. If he steps out of line, he'll have me to answer to. He'd be sorry he ever had a sniff of Mandy Wilkins.
He's a bloody good boxer, actually, Matt.
He's only a middleweight. Anyway, he's talking about boxing. I'm talking about fighting. The kind of fighting that you learn on the streets.
What, street fighting?
Yeah. Forget your Queensby rules, pal. I'm talking about savage bloodletting.
Was this what you picked up on the streets of Herne Bay, then?
Martin, I could have him. End of story, all right?
There we go.
Okay, listen, that's Paul come to get me. Do you mind if I bring him in here while I finish getting ready?
No, wheel him in. Let's have a look at him.
All right.
Hello,
nice to meet you.
Martin, and this is Matthew.
Hi, mate.
Hello.
Nice to meet you.
I'm just
going to
finish getting ready. I won't be
Thanks.
Do you want a drink? Do they call you Paul or Rage?
No, just Paul usually. Or Sir.
Only kidding. there's a bottle of lager, I think, or a cup of tea.
Oh, I'll have a lager, thanks. I'm not driving.
So there we go. I think we've seen enough.
Is waxing the surfboard meant to be a very laboured visual metaphor for cooming?
I don't know, but he constantly does do it.
Stay home and wax your board. Mm.
Oh, I think we're done. I think we're done. We played the vid for too long. We might come on.
Oh, shit, yeah. No, it still says live.
We better go then. Hold on. It might come back. It might bring us back. It'll bring us back. Hold on. We watched the vid for too long because of the BBC's copyright laws. It'll bring us back in a minute. It comes back on usually. Here we go.
Okay.
Yeah. Still not back. It's been interrupted, it says. It will bring us back at some point.
What does it do? Does it give you a copyright strike or anything like that?
No. It just interrupts it. And then it re-enables it after you stop doing it. Because I would just stop, but there's super chats. So. Mm-hmm. It will come back.
Oh, okay.
It's happened before. It happened with Postman Pat.
I'm sure it was also some film you were doing as well at one time, like a horror movie or something that.
There we go. Yeah, we're back. We're back. Okay. So for those who managed to live through that, I will do some super chats. Coney says, anyway, if you missed it, the black guy comes in and then sits in a very dominant manner, puts his arm around Matthew. I just find it quite, I mean, it's just a little bit dark, I think. Anyway, Coney says, as someone who grew up in the 2000s as a child and then a teenager in the 2010s, it seemed that the lad culture of the 2000s that had been normalized suddenly got demonized around 2013. So now you were supposed to let go of the laddism you grew up with Top Gear, which was seen as anachronistic and sexist, etc. Cultural hipsters at school became social enforcers of feminism. This alienated me against feminism and got me watching Sargon. I was a noughties kid expecting the 10s to have the same political culture, but the Overton window made a shift and left me out in the cold. So there we go. Coney says that the shift happened in 2013. What do you guys reckon? About right, 2013?
Hard to say, but he could well be right.
Yeah, I can't pin it down, really.
Years the Eunuch says, lad culture is a surrogate for a man's journey into maturity. They were given a game of masculinity to play in place of proper male role models, no doubt a product of the Ashes, an anti-white mind cancer. Ironically, this is toxic masculinity. So there we go.
Something about that I can understand, actually, because it does feel like it's a kind of hand-me-down version of masculinity, isn't it? A kind of sort of shabby ritual, you know, like, here, make do with this.
Yeah, I mean, it's that's a fakery of it all, as we've been talking about. Benjamin Sugarworth says, Vindaloo, 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 na, na. Yeah, that was another anthem. Coney says, these bread tube avatars are out of hand. What bread tube avatars? We've got, I mean, I'm Chairman Mao. The demigod put this together. Who are you, Thomas?
I'm Lord Jacob Rothschild.
And Simon, you're just yourself.
Me 10 years ago, yeah.
Piers Taylor says, Simon's mention of the Sweeney and kicking in doors reminded me of Ashes to Ashes with Keely Hawes, a kind of anti-Sweeney counter-Laddis series. Delta Striker 125 says, sub to Thomas.
Thanks very much, Delta.
Machiavelli Sucks to Go says, like I give a sheet what the Guardian thinks, lol. He also says, oh my god, that picture of Rothschild is annoying. I also got a message from my buddy Ophir, who's from Israel, who says, I met the real one.
Oh.
Deplorable Patriarch says, Badil got a double first from King's College, Cambridge, Keynes's College, and the hotbed of student leftism at the time. Yeah, I mean, Badil is an utter subversive in all ways. And I just don't believe, like, I just don't really understand or believe that he was ever part of Laddism. And he generally looked uncomfortable even on fantasy football. Even in that clip we watched, he didn't look that happy, did he? All right. Anything you would like to plug, Thomas?
Can I just make a brief point about Robert Newman, who was the partner of Badil originally? And yes, what I really hated about him is that, you know, this is a guy, he did comedy and then he wanted to do something serious. And can you imagine, of all the things he picks, is the thing he chooses to be serious about is climate change? I mean, I find it an interesting phenomenon that these people, whenever they do anything serious, they are always retarded leftists of the highest caliber. But, you know, that's all I wanted to say.
Anything you'd like to share?
For me, come and join us on Friday afternoon on Hector Drummond's channel for the Guff stream at 1 o'clock. But actually, I would like to actually encourage people to go and listen to that Rittenhouse stream you did today, which I think was a really good stream. I don't want to bring back any bad memories for anyone, but I'm really enjoying that. I'm about halfway through at the moment, and I think it's a good point to have that conversation, the friend-enemy distinction at this point. And I think it brings out some really interesting provocative thoughts in people to consider at this difficult time.
Yeah, are you aware, Thomas, that Carl Rittenhouse came out and said I'm a supporter of BLM, or I'm a supporter of the BLM movement?
Yes, I saw you reacting to this on Twitter today. That's how I first learned about it. I kind of agree with what you're saying. I mean, what's the point if after all of that he's going to come out and say he still supports BLM? Well, it makes you wonder if the normie can ever learn to understand, and probably it seemingly they can't.
Did you have anything you would like to shill? Anything you'd like, any recent streams you've done? Or
I would say if people want to go to my channel, it's Thomas Barden Reese. I've done quite a few streams lately with various people, either on news stuff or on dissecting, you know, false people on the right, etc. The AA has thankfully given me some plugs recently. So if people want to check me out, you know, you're welcome to, and I'd be very grateful.
Yeah, I haven't watched the one you've done yet called The Worst Virtue Signaling Celebrities in the UK. I noticed Badil was on the front cover of that.
Yes, we had a good go at him. He's a man I can't stand, and he was definitely one of the worst.
He's just kind of the inheritor of the mantle of Ben Elton, really.
But on the subject of Ben Elton and Badil and just the whole stream, really, I do think that comedy is that one area where people still have a lot of fondness for, I mean, Blackadder, for example. I mean, I'm fond of Blackadder. We all grew up with it. But these are still hidden nodes of subversion in your consciousness and in your, in the way that you think of things. And don't forget, you know, who wrote Blackadder. And the, there is all sorts of hidden leftism in cultural leftism in a lot of the things that you're fond of. And I think that's one of the most difficult things about becoming red-pilled, as it were, that you have to turn on the things that you love and the things that are dear to you, and see them in a new light, which is, you know, is a difficult process, I think.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I'd 100% echo that. It is traumatic in the extreme to find out that everything you sort of loved in your childhood is actually poisoned with this cultural Marxist filth. But of course, we have to accept this, because if, as I and many others do, you know, if we say that our society has been degenerating for 250 years, then inevitably virtually everything that we hold dear has been poisoned with this filth. I think you have to be pragmatic when it comes to these things. You have to understand that, yes, we have been in decline for 250 years, but at the same time, that doesn't mean that every episode, you know, you can't watch an episode of Blackadder or Fawlty Towers.
Yeah, we kind of talked about this on that stream, didn't we? Discussing the virtue signaling celebrities, that, you know, my feeling is very much that there's certain figures who will have this kind of curatorial function. And it is odd how, you know, it used to be Ben Elton, but now it's kind of David Baddiel who comes out every now and again to kind of wag a finger at something in culture. You know, he's kind of one of the sort of go-to renter pundits for that sort of stuff.
Yes, I'm just replying to Keith Woods about the prospect of doing yet another stream today.
I'm going to need
a debate, but I'm going to need to sleep if I'm going to be on form for that debate, because I haven't slept since midnight. I mean, it's,
oh god.
Yes, I don't see, it's difficult, but you have to be, I think it's just one of those things you have to be aware of. Without it kind of ruining your enjoyment of absolutely everything. You know, I kind of find that I seek refuge in things like Carry On movies and things like that, which, you know, are probably subversive in their own way as well, but they're kind of innocent as well. And of a world, I kind of like watching things from that era. Even like, it sounds ridiculous, but like, if you go on YouTube and search for like Beatles songs, even the things that you, even like Beatles videos seem like a completely lost world. I mean, they were probably in the process of destroying it themselves, but it's still quite good to watch footage of that era. I tend to go back. I also like 70s shows with grainy footage. You know, somebody mentioned the Sweeney. Yeah. So I tend to kind of seek refuge in that sort of thing. If I actually bother watching any TV these days, if I'm ever left at home alone and I feel myself reaching for the TV remotes, I'll inevitably go onto Challenge TV and watch an episode of Bullseye from the 1980s with Jim Bowen, or I'll go to BBC iPlayer and go to the archive section. And I'll usually land on a train documentary from the 1950s, probably hosted by John Betjeman. So that's what I end up doing most of the time. All right. Thank you if you've made it all the way through. We did have a little bit of an interruption. If this stream disappears, it's because Susan does not want the copyrighted stuff up. We'll see what she says after we finish. You can buy a course at the Academic Agency, Autumn 25, but most importantly of all, get out.